Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us right now at 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. As always, along with your interesting calls, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, fussy eaters. If you nag your kids to eat the right foods essentially, is that going to help them eat the right foods, or are they going to become finicky eaters? Some interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Interesting indeed. And?
Whitney Houston recently died. Awful death. I think we're going to talk about her today and talk a little bit about addiction and some new research on marijuana and driving.
Yeah. And driving. Our recipe this time.
Pork chop sandwiches. Now, you normally don't think of pork chops as something that's healthy, but if I tell you how to eat pork chops in a healthy way, and now it's not the other white meat, but how to eat it in a healthy way, you may find this a good, delicious recipe. It may be something that you'll like.
Loyal listeners will recognize this recipe from the past, as it's a recipe from the vault. Don't forget, our medical myth buster is coming up later on in the program. Right now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener. We welcome our first caller, a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
I have a question for Dr. Zorba. When I was 15, I'm 20 now, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease, and ever since then, I cannot stay warm. For the life of me, I bundle up, but even in the summertime, I am always cold. Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas for me?
Now, Zorba, of course, knows. What disease did you say?
Hashimoto's.
Oh, okay. You want to tell us what that is? Zorba, why don't you?
Okay. It is when my body attacks my thyroid. It thinks of it as a foreign body, and so it just kills my thyroid, and I have to take a synthetic thyroid for it.
That's right. That's right. And that's exactly what it is. Hashimoto's thyroiditis, it's called, is where you produce antibodies to your thyroid and your thyroid stops functioning and a number of other things occur. But ultimately, then you need to be on thyroid replacement when all is said and done. I want to talk a little bit about it. So when you got it when you were – how old were you when it came?
I was 15.
15. Young age for that to occur. What kind of symptoms did you have to – you know, I mean, that's unusual and for a 15-year-old to have it. What kind of symptoms did you have initially?
Initially, I had a very large goiter, and then I was also gaining weight for no reason.
Got you. Did you have to have surgery on the goiter, by the way?
No, I didn't. They started me immediately on the thyroid medication, and it was pretty much under control after that, but we were never able to get my temperature back up.
Wonderful. Talking now about that, so what happens is you take thyroid medication, then we measure it in your bloodstream. We do a certain test to make sure that thyroid medication is in the right range, but it's a range that it's in. So we measure something called TSH. It's just the way we measure it and look at it. Are you in the low part of that range or the upper part of that range?
As I recall, I'm in the low part.
Okay. There are a number of very interesting anecdotal studies that have shown that different thyroid replacement may affect people differently. In other words, you're on a synthetic hormone. There's no doubt about it. But some people say that a Synthroid, which is the standard, doesn't work as well as other medications that are out there. And I'm not talking about the old-fashioned thyroid that was made by Armour Thyroid that really came from either beef products or pork products. That's a totally different thing. But so what you may want to do is talk to your doctor and say, look, I want to try a different brand. Mm-hmm. Some people try a brand that has more T3, it's called, in it than T4, and they actually say they feel better. So you want to be in the range where you're maximizing the amount of thyroid medication. That's number one. And once again, it's a range. And you want to try a different type of thyroid medication if you've been on the same one all along. And then you want to see if that makes a difference. So that's one of the things that I would do. Now, when you say you're cold, is it your extremities, your hands, your feet, or just your entire body?
It's mostly you can really feel it in my hands. My whole body just feels cold.
Your whole body feels cold. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would change the kind of thyroid medication and I would look at the dosing. Those are the things I would do. And in Wisconsin, we also recommend winter silk long underwear, which will make you feel awesome.
Yeah, that's
what I do. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
800-462-7413.
You know, it's interesting when it comes to medications that replace a normal hormone, such as thyroid, often physicians think of it as, well, as long as I'm within the range, I'm okay. But once again, there are people anecdotally who say, no, I want to be in the high part of the range or the low part of the range. Too much and I feel jittery, too little and I feel sluggish.
I still
sluggish.
Have my maximum question. I assume you could get too much.
Absolutely. If you get too much thyroid, you run a risk of osteoporosis. And so you don't want to have too much thyroid. And if you're just barely in control, well, then you may have a little bit too little for what your needs are. If you're a young person and you're exercising, you may need more energy, for instance, than somebody in their 60s.
I get it. So let's talk about parents nagging their kids to eat.
Yes, nagging, nagging, nagging. Did your mom nag you?
No, she didn't.
Wait a second. Did she make you eat canned peas?
Well, she didn't nag. She just set it in front of me, and I ate them.
You ate canned peas? Did you like them?
Well, I was a kid. What did I know?
When was the last time you ate canned peas?
Oh, when I was a kid.
I think of canned peas as absolutely. But this was a study in the American Dietetic Association, because this is a big issue.
Yeah.
Your kids have become very fussy, finicky eaters. I remember when I was a kid, we had a neighbor next door, and her daughter, who was a little bit younger than I was, would only eat for lunch BLT sandwiches. Mm-hmm. And when she went to college, that's all she continued eating were BLT sandwiches. She had a very, very narrow eating spectrum. So anyway, this was a study that looked at whether or not parents who strictly control what their children eat versus parents who are a little bit more lenient and allow their kids to sort of eat in a non-controlling manner, who does better and who becomes fussy eaters. And basically, the parents who were more controlling were more likely to have children who became fussier and fussier and fussier and narrower and narrower and narrower in what they would eat. And these were moms for the most part. And basically, if moms put too much pressure on their kids to eat healthy food, they may become very fussy children.
Well, why would that be?
Well, maybe it's because kids want to, you know, if you're putting too much. Well, let's talk about control. Do you like somebody controlling you all the time?
You don't like it.
Yeah.
But I don't know that would, if somebody was trying to control me to do something, would make me.
Well, here it is. You're a child, okay? Yeah. So you don't have a lot of control over many things in your environment. You get things through your parents, right? And so you learn to manipulate your parents so you can get what you want. And I don't mean it in a negative way. Yeah. That's how kids get things. They can't, you know, get food and other things. Yeah. And so here it is. Somebody's telling you, do this, eat this. And the only control you have over your environment is to say, no, I'm not going to eat that.
I guess that is true, because as a kid, my mom didn't like it if I had a lot of soda pop. And I drink soda now. I mean, not excessively.
So it may be a rebellion. Now, that's a normal part of developmental process whereby you separate yourself out from your mom and dad and you say, I'm an individual person. Yeah. And it starts when you're a young person. But when it relates to food, if there's too much pressure on the child, they may become fussy eaters as an adult, not eat vegetables, not eat fruits. I mean, I have lots of patients in my office, especially guys, and they'll say, I don't eat a lot of vegetables. Yeah. What does that mean? Well, they eat corn and potatoes. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, and they have a little lettuce salad and they don't have anything else. Yeah. So, you know, you don't want a fussy adults because then they become poor eaters
as
adults.
So let your kids eat whatever they
want.
Well,
it's not exactly that extreme. We're talking about absolute pressure. We're not talking about Snickers for dessert or Hostess cream-filled cupcakes every single day.
800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to a listener now in Sandpoint, Idaho. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help you?
When I went to high school, I stopped eating breakfast. I only had like a bowl of cereal, but in high school, you know, I got to get out of the house really fast. And one time I bought a thing of juice out of a vending machine. I tried to eat healthy. They had pop. And that day, I had this terrible pain in my upper body, in my throat, my upper arms, my chest. I just wanted to curl up into the fetal position. And just because I wanted to experiment, I'm like, okay, what causes pain? And so the next day I bought the same juice and it happened again. And since I've learned, I cannot eat fruit juice in the morning without eating something first, without just feeling this very full body pain. And I have looked it up online. I have not been able to figure out what this is. I was wondering if Zorba had any suggestions for me.
Well, first of all, I love the fact that you looked it up online. I mean, I do love Google. It's wonderful. So, you know, you put in a few search words, and if it's not on the first or second page, you sort of scratch your head, which is it.
Yeah.
And there was, I mean, you know, just what I'm talking about. And it's very interesting because there was a study recently done that was published, I think, in JAMA or the New England Journal that looked at Google and the and looked at physicians looking at Google, young physicians, residents, and so on, putting in symptoms. And then seeing if the correct diagnosis was on the screen. And usually it was within the first four screens. In other words, it wasn't always on the first screen, but it might have been on the third and the fourth screen, which is, of course, we rarely get to it. I mean, you know, you get to screen number two and then you – then I lose interest usually. So let's look – so first of all, you did the right thing, but you didn't get your answer. Is this a problem in your stomach? Is there a burning feeling in the pit of your stomach?
Not really. I feel it mostly in my shoulders, my upper arms, and my throat. But I will feel it throughout my body, but it's mostly my upper arms. And I just want to curl up in a fetal position. It's very painful.
What kind of juice is it that produces this? Is it citrus or apple? Or
I've had it with orange juice and grape juice. Mm-hmm. I had it with apple juice once a little while ago. You know, because I just graduated from college. It's been years since I've eaten fruit juice in the morning. I'm like, well, let's see if I still have it. So I drank a whole bunch of apple juice in the morning, and yes, I still have it.
What now? A whole bunch means 6 ounces, 8 ounces,
probably
a quart,
maybe one big glass, like a oversized glass.
So an oversized glass worth of juice. As soon as you take it, it happens, or
no, maybe within the next 10-15 minutes, and then it'll go away after about 5 or 10 minutes.
Any nausea or vomiting associated with it?
Yes, nausea, vomiting. Mm-hmm. No, not really, but yes, there is nausea.
Okay, so there's some nausea. What attenuates it? What decreases it? If you have food in your stomach, other food in your stomach?
Yes. Like in high school, if I did have it, I went and drank a lot of water, or I tried to go get some food, and that seemed like it made it feel better. I don't know if it was like walking to go get the water that made it feel better, but those things I always did because it helped the pain.
Okay. One last question. Any other foods that seem to do this or any other times of the day? You've experienced it with other things at all?
No. I did experience it, though, at night once. I drank a whole bunch of orange juice after I got home without eating that day, and I experienced it.
Okay. So it's on an empty stomach. What I think you have is what's called an exaggerated vagal response. Now, the vagus nerve is a very interesting nerve. It does a lot of things. It regulates. It's part of sort of the flight or fright regulation. It's the opposite of the adrenal response. The vagal nerve affects the gut, the entire gut. The vagal nerve also affects our heartbeat. When we get faint, for instance, the vagal nerve is really taken over and we start to sweat and we feel nauseous and we feel uncomfortable. And some people, when the vagal nerve is overstimulated, actually fall down and completely faint. And some have a significant problem, which we determine with something called a tilt table test, because they start having these fainting attacks. So the vagal nerve is an interesting nerve that's very important in our function. When you are on an empty stomach and you have, as you said, it's usually juice. You've mentioned citrus is a common thing that goes into the stomach, and our stomach starts to work. For whatever reason, you have an overactive vagal nerve, and that's what's going on. The vagal nerve does a lot of stuff in the gut, and on an empty stomach, for whatever reason, either it's the sweetness, the cold, or if it's citrus, it's the acidity of the citrus, is overstimulating the vagal nerve. That's what I think is happening. And usually, the treatment for this is nothing in terms of any medication. You wouldn't take any medication, but avoid the foods that are doing it. But I think this is a vasovagal response. That's what this is. If you go back to Google and you Google vasovagal response and you read about it, that's what this sounds like to me. Now, why it's happening to you and why it happens with this specific food on an empty stomach in the morning, I do not have the foggiest idea. You are an enigma. That is a puzzle to me of why it would happen, because usually it happens with people with other foods. It's usually not one food. It's usually a number of foods that will do it. So you're not going to have cancer, heart disease, or die from it. And obviously you need a bagel with that orange juice. That's what you need.
Yes, sir.
So good luck. Please let us know what happens. And
okay, we will. I will. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the call. Thank you. 1-800-462-7413. You'll find a line open now. And a caller with us now, Zorba, in Spokane, Washington. Hello.
Tom, Zorba. Love the show.
Thank you. How
Thank
can we
you.
Help?
I have a question about washing fresh produce before eating it, and specifically about apples. I eat apples regularly. Like, you know, I have one a day almost. And I take them to work and, you know, good snack for mid-morning or mid-afternoon. And I usually, you know, go in the lunchroom and go to the sink and rinse them off. Lately, I've used a couple of drops of dishwashing liquid that's sitting there on the sink and a little warm water when I wash them. But I also noticed that the soaps are noted to be antibacterial. And I was just wondering about the wisdom of my approach here to washing apples. Can you help me out with that, whether that's I'm doing the wrong thing or not?
Oh, sure. You know, I don't – first of all, we use – if you look at dishwashing soap, you know, there often is a residue on the dishes. But using antibacterial soap, that's what you're using to wipe it, or dishwasher soap?
It's not stuff you put in the automatic dishwasher. It's the liquid that you just use in the sink ordinarily. But it says it's antibacterial on it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, you know, Americans have become nuts for antibacterial stuff all of the time. You know, that's what sells. So it's antibacterial because we're sort of, you know, even though we're populated by bacteria, we sort of want to make sure we keep it away. And bacteria in food and food poisoning from bacteria are really a major problem. I mean, they're a major problem with things like chicken, not with veggies, but things like chicken and E. coli, hamburger meat, and so on. And there have been a number of studies of this looking at people. I think it's important to wash produce when you bring it home because people touch it like you, and they're touching the apples. And like you said, you're picking out the best apple. Other people are picking that out. So I think washing it with water is fine. I don't think the soap residue is going to do anything wrong. I don't think you're in any harm's way by doing that, because if it's dishwasher soap, there often is residue of dishwasher soap on dishes when people wash them by hand.
Right.
So it's been looked at. It's generally considered safe by the FDA. That's not a problem. I wouldn't use antibacterial soap for my hands like the ones that we use in the office. But that's probably not a problem either. But obviously, it has some chemical in it. So I think you're okay. Now, the other question is, do you have to do this?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other question.
Right.
And the studies that I've read have said there is no advantage to doing this over washing it with plain water.
Really?
Yes, there are no studies that have shown that there's less food poisoning by actually just taking it, washing it with water, just taking your hands and washing it with water and getting the surface bacteria off the soap. Mm-hmm. I mean, off the apple, excuse me. So I don't think you have to go that far. Now, you may want to go that far because you feel like you're doing a better job, but the studies don't support that. And it's kind of been a big issue because for a while, and you can still go to the grocery store, they sell soaps and they go wash your vegetables and get them really clean. And especially when we hear things such as, you know, the epidemic that occurred with spinach that occurred a few years ago. But those bacteria that were sort of hiding beneath the leaves of spinach, if they had actually washed the spinach and spun it dry, you would have gotten rid of those bacteria. So,
okay.
So I think you're doing more than you have to do.
Okay.
On the other hand, you're finicky enough in terms of your apple that you might decide you just want to do it because you feel better.
Great. Well, very helpful. Thank you so much.
Good.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You.
Good we... luck. Good luck on staying healthy. And by the way, what's your favorite apple?
Fuji's.
Fuji's. I love Fuji's.
Yep.
Fuji's are really good. I love
now,
Fuji's.
You gave me that look just because I like delicious apples.
That's exactly
you knew
it.
The answer.
Tom is a delicious guy. I like a Fuji or a Honeycrisp, but Tom is a Fuji guy.
We appreciate the call. Thank you. Before the break, Zorba, you'd better dust off your gavel because you need to rule on another Judge Zorba case. Today's case has to do with soda. Chris from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, is putting his cousin on trial. At a recent family get-together, both of their young sons asked Chris and his cousin for a soda. In an effort to choose the healthiest option, Chris suggested caffeinated diet soda. His cousin thought otherwise. He recommended a non-caffeinated regular soda. So, Judge Zorba, which is the lesser of two evils? caffeine, or sugar.
Oh my gosh! You know, I mean, this is the problem with Solomon. I mean, that's exactly it. You know, that's exactly it. You know, it's really, you know, this is a function. You know, I'm a caffeine guy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a caffeine guy, so I'm going to come down on the side of caffeine.
Yeah.
I think a little dash of caffeine is good for the body, good for the soul, good for the brain, and life without caffeine is frankly dull.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to come down on the caffeine side. Now, I may get people who disagree with me, who say, wait a minute, this is impure. But yeah, after all, it's soda.
Okay.
We're not talking about caffeine and juice.
Right.
You get what you want. You want that sugar, you might as well. Or you want the, you know, the diet stuff, you might as well get the caffeine and enjoy your day.
And if your lifestyle debate is too sweet or too amped up to settle, send your case to Judge Zorba. Just send your affidavit in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up, lots more of your calls, some more interesting research, and of course our medical myth buster later on right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up at 1-800-462-7413. Some interesting research to talk over, and of course our medical myth buster. But first, Zorba, recipe time. And today we have, as we sometimes do, a recipe from the vault, highlighting a past favorite. Today's Blast from the Past recipe is a Zorba Pastor on Your Health production staff favorite, pork chop sandwiches. It was created by our former producer, Rob Ferret. Boy, do I miss Rob sometimes. but not that often, to tell you the truth. Our current producer...
Wait a minute. He may be listening. That is not a very nice thing to say.
Our current producer used his 00 security clearance to access our recipe vault to dig this one out. So without further ado, here is the encore presentation of pork chop sandwiches.
Wait, I want to know what the code is to get into the vault. You know, I've seen it. You know, it's there. It's got a great big lock. It clanks when it goes in.
Yeah.
You know, if I don't know the code,
you
I get
you
stuck
know
the in
combination.
The vault. Not at all. I don't,
well, you don't
have
need
the combination.
To, because
no,
you
I
have
don't.
It all right up
that's
here.
That's some of my brain. That's exactly.
Every single
I don't
recipe.
Need the combination. So let's talk about pork. It is not the other white meat. You
right.
know, that was their advertising, because when you cook it, it looks white. Chicken is the white meat. And, you know, and when we look from a point of view, pork is red meat, and it has the disadvantages of red meat. Now, on the other hand, you can eat pork, and pork can be a delicious food, especially if you use something such as a pork tenderloin or other type of pork chop, where you get rid of the fat. That's the issue. If you look at a pork chop, it's that fat on the outside that is responsible for lots of the calories that you don't need.
Mm-hmm.
And let's remember, pork fat is also called lard. You know, it's also called lard. So, and you know, we sort of know what lard is. So let's talk about this. I happen to like pork, and I think this is a wonderful, wonderful recipe, which is why I thought it was a great idea to take this from the vault too. So we start out with 2 teaspoons of olive oil.
2 little tea olive oil.
That's right, 2 teaspoons. 4 butterfly pork chops, thinly cut and trimmed.
4 butterfly pork chops, thinly cut and trimmed.
Now, one of the reasons that we are heavier and heavier and heavier in America today is the fact that we're eating more and more and more. And our producer, Adam, just talked about the fact that sometimes his family would get together. I don't know if there are 4, 6, or 8 in the family. And they would have 1 tombstone pizza. And he looked back and he said, how did we have 1 tombstone pizza? I can consume a tombstone
pizza
myself.
That is true.
And the fact is, the pork chops chop is okay, thinly cut. You don't have to get a massively 2-inch thick pork chop. Get it thinly cut so that you actually can enjoy it and you don't have too many calories. Four English muffins. Do you like English muffins?
Not so much.
I love English muffins. But my grandmother was English on one side. One side Polish, one side English.
Well,
and we used to have
it.
Crumpets. That's what she called them, crumpets, which are slightly, almost the same. Mm-hmm. A cup of alfalfa sprouts.
Cup of alfalfa sprouts.
That's right. Four slices of tomato.
Four slices of tomato.
They should call it tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Some romaine lettuce leaves.
Romaine lettuce leaves.
Now, we have a sauce. Okay, so we have a sauce.
Okay.
Here's the sauce. 4 tablespoonfuls of sour cream, reduced fat.
4 big T sour cream, reduced fat.
Now, when you go to the grocery store, Tom, do you get the regular sour cream or the reduced fat or the no fat when you purchase that?
Well, it depends on whether I ever have done that one way or the other or not.
One of these days I'm going to follow you around the grocery store and just see.
It won't take long.
Wait, it won't take long.
10-15 minutes.
10-15 minutes, that's it? That's it.
I've got my pattern. I got
same
my
pattern.
Stuff. I get the same stuff.
Same shop? You go to the same shop?
Oh, sure, of course. I can't understand any of those other grocery stores. They don't have anything in the right place.
It's all in the wrong place. Yeah. Where's my ketchup? I can't find it. 1 tablespoonful of tomato paste.
1 big T tomato paste.
1 tablespoonful of fresh lime juice.
A big T fresh lime juice.
That's right, fresh. If you can get it, much better than the reconstituted. If you're going to go to the process of getting the pork chops, then get yourself a lime. Much better.
Yeah.
A half teaspoon of cumin, ground cumin.
Ground cumin.
And as I've told you before, I buy my cumin in Hispanic grocery stores or Asian grocery stores. It is 1/4 of the price that I found in a regular grocery store. And salt and pepper to taste.
I haven't had these. I'm trying to figure out what the taste would be of that sauce.
I mean, because it's got
the sour cream,
sour
the tomato
cream,
paste, the lime juice, the cumin, salt and pepper.
There's something called umami, which is the fifth taste. That's presently what a number of food people think. Mm-hmm. You have salt, sugar, bitter, and sour. And the fifth taste is fullness. And we know that sometimes you bite into a sandwich and it has that fullness. And sometimes it's flat. Mm-hmm. This sauce seems to me would give a lot of fullness because you've got tomato on one hand, sour cream, lime, and cumin. What an interesting combination.
Yeah, that is.
Okay. What you're going to do is coat a large skillet with olive oil. Mm-hmm. I use Teflon in this case, always because you need less oil if you use Teflon. Over medium heat, cook the pork chops for 3 to 5 minutes per side until they're browned and cooked through. Very important. There is no trichinosis anymore in America because pork producers have stopped feeding garbage to pigs. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, they don't do it. There's no more trichinosis around. Now, there may be an occasional trichinosis, but believe me, you're more likely to die on the way to the grocery store than get trichinosis. Yeah. So cook through, but not overly cooked. Then combine all the sauce ingredients, stir well. Then toast an English muffin, sandwich bun if you want to, but I'll take the crumpet. Serve the pork chop on the muffin with alfalfa sprouts, put a tomato, romaine lettuce, a dollop of the sauce, or if you're like me, I probably wouldn't put the sauce in, but I dip it into the sauce because I kind of like it that way. And you've got a 287-calorie delicious sandwich.
Yeah. I'd do a soft roll instead of...
You would do a soft roll. Yeah. So you like that. You like it in a... Yeah. A soft roll would be good. A tasty sourdough or non-sourdough?
Either one would be okay.
Either one would be good. So you've got a sandwich for 287 calories. Now, I want to bring up an important point here. It's the thinness of the butterfly pork chop that makes it such a low-calorie sandwich.
Yeah.
And to compare it to other sandwiches, a Subway sandwich... I go to Subway. They're right near my office.
Yeah.
A tuna sandwich is 560 calories. It's 50% more than this sandwich. Mm-hmm. If you get the seafood, it's 50% more than the sandwich. So this is a low-calorie sandwich, is what it is.
Sounds really good, too.
It's good. It's tasty. Try it.
If there's a recipe you feel deserves a career revival, let us know about it, and it might just end up being our next Recipe from the Vault. Simply send the name of the recipe in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener with us in Atlanta, Texas. Hi.
Hello there.
How can we help?
Well, I hope you can. I'm trying to increase my calorie and such intake because I'm considerably underweight and been told that for years. And I need to put on a few pounds if I can.
Yeah. What is your height and weight?
I'm 6'1 and about 140 soaking wet.
Well, what do you think, Tom? Tom is a thin guy.
Yeah.
Is that underweight or not?
That's about my weight, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm 6 feet and about 150, so not quite that thin.
Yeah. You know, 5% of the population is underweight and wants to gain weight. And it's interesting because there always are the jokes from the majority of our society that's overweight that says, you know, ha, 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 you know, you're underweight, you're lucky, and what you ought to do is I'd like to trade you some. But the fact is people who are underweight have some of the same issues as people who are overweight, certainly in, you know, in terms of—
Was 6'1", 145, seriously
pretty,
underweight?
You know, that's, well, it's thin. Yeah. Got to ask you a few questions. You a healthy guy?
Well, yes, sir. I wear a pedometer, and I do every bit of 15,000 steps a day, if not occasionally 20,000 steps.
So you do 15,000 to 20,000 steps a day. You know what the average American gets when they actually put on their pedometer? Guess.
I'm going to say about 10,000.
2,500 steps a day. 2,500 steps a day is what the average American gets. That's what you get. 10,000 steps is roughly 5 miles of walking a day. So you're walking between 7.5 and 10 miles a day. And that's, by the way, that's where a lot of your calories are going to. What do you do for a living?
Well, it's a heavy lifting and such in a military surplus warehouse.
Okay. So so you're doing, you know, 7 to 10, 10 miles a day of walking.
And heavy lifting.
Heavy lifting. But you feel good. You're obviously healthy. You're doing healthy things. Do you want to gain weight for your body self-image, or do you want to gain weight because people say you ought to gain weight?
Well, if I may add, I eat enough, honestly, for every bit of 3, if not 12 people.
Well, I'm sure, with the amount of exercise you're getting, I'm not. Yeah. I am not surprised that. How about your mom and your dad? Were they thin? Who was thin in your family?
My dad was thin. My mother wasn't.
Yeah, and usually this is just like obesity can run in families. Thinness can absolutely definitely run in families, and kids often follow one step or the other step. So, getting back to what you have, if you want to gain weight, if you look at fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. You know, the real issue is, in America, we like to always think that there's a bad food. You know, something is bad for us. So carbs are now kind of the bad boys on the block. They're the ones we should stay away from. If we look 10 years ago, it was fats. We had to stay away from the fats, and the carbs were okay. And the fact is, all food is good, as long as it's well-balanced in the right amount. I like the Michael Pollan concept, which is eat what you're familiar with, what your family used to eat. That's probably the best way to look at it. And just make sure it's balanced food. So I don't think you need more bagels. I think you're probably at exactly the right weight because it sounds to me like you've been there for a long time. What'd you weigh after high school?
About 140.
So you've been at the same weight. Good studies that have come out, longitudinal studies have shown people who are within 10% of their high school graduation rate weight have the best longevity and the best mortality, and least mortality. They're most likely to live long and live a healthy life. So I think you're about right, and I don't think I'd be concerned.
Oh, really?
Yes.
All righty then. Well, you're the expert.
Thanks a lot. I wish my wife said that at home. Honey, you're the expert. I'll take your advice. It doesn't work that way, let me tell you. Thank you so much for your call.
Well, thank you, Dr. Zorba, and thank you, Mr. West.
Okay.
Take care.
A good listener. Time now, Zorba, for a quick tip from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This helpful hint comes to us from Carol in Appleton, Wisconsin, and offers a frugal solution to a cooking wine problem. Carol writes, "For those who hesitate to open a bottle of wine to use just a cup, remember that wine freezes beautifully. Just pour what is not needed into a container and freeze. It will never freeze solid so that some of it can be spooned out for future use in cooking. The quality remains good. Freezing does not seem to affect it. I have a container of red and one of white in my freezer and always have wine available for cooking.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful. I've never, ever heard of that. I never thought about that. You know, I use...
You think of the concept and you think, uck.
Yeah, uck, right, right. I wouldn't drink. On the other end, it's cooking wine. We're talking about using something for cooking. It's not the same. I'm not going to say bring out the frozen wine and serve it. I could just see taking out a Ziploc container and then saying, oh, let's have wine for dinner, pouring out of it. I'm going to try that. Next time we have people over for dinner, I'm going to say, try this frozen wine. I put it up 2 years ago in the
spoon
freezer.
Spoon out into the wine glass.
Yeah, let it defrost. We'll see how that goes with my foodie friends.
Hey, but for cooking, huh?
Hey, for cooking, they don't know the difference. No, for cooking, it wouldn't matter.
Well, if you're in a helpful spirit or can offer some help about spirits, lend us a hand with your lifestyle tip. Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. I just love our listeners. They are so creative and they love to share their stuff. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
We'll be hearing from more listeners. Also, an interesting topic to talk over, and of course, our medical myth-busting here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Back to the phones in a while, but before that, Zorba, the world was shocked by the passing of Whitney Houston. Tragic, and we'll talk some about
that now, and
substance abuse, which many think played a part in her passing.
Tragic and awful. When someone of that fame dies, somebody who has affected so many lives, you know, with the beauty of her music, it's something that we all find tragic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the question is, when do you start to talk about what she died from? I mean, you know, the toxicology reports are not back yet, but she was found in a bathtub in a hotel room face down.
And she's had a history, of course,
of abuse. So the chances are far more likely than not that there was, you know, that there were drugs involved with this. And although you hate to talk about it now, this is actually the best time to talk about it because you've got people's attention. And so this is the time to say, how do we prevent this with others? Mm-hmm. You know, when we look at drugs globally, the problem is you can get treatment and you have recidivism where it goes back and you get treatment and recidivism. But that doesn't mean the first treatment may not work or the second treatment or the third treatment. Eventually, for many, many people, they can conquer addiction if they have the proper back up the proper way of essentially beginning to treat.
One of the things that's been talked about here is the prescription drug abuse, which can be, I guess, worse than things that we hear more about, cocaine and...
Absolutely. Because in her case, I know that, you know, because I read a lot of the articles that everyone else did, they found Xanax, which is a very good example of a drug that's a prescription drug abuse. And years ago, it was Valium, you know, and now it's Xanax and it's Alprazolam and other drugs.
Where one of these drugs may be okay in proper amounts, combining drugs can be really bad.
Right. And one of the problems are, for many people, they may see two or three doctors, so they don't necessarily tell one. There's no national database, so they may see one doctor 1 week, see another doctor another week. They don't necessarily interact with each other because they don't know about each other, and all of a sudden there's abuse, and the person who's abusing knows what they're doing because they're manipulating, and then tragic results like this.
Not so long ago, shortly before she died, she was doing an interview saying that she had kicked everything, that she was looking forward to the future.
An addict cannot
be an addict for a while or think that this
Well, that goes back and forth, of course. And then, of course, addicts lie. I mean, addicts lie all the time. Maybe she was okay and maybe she wasn't okay. We don't really know. But an addict can be very good and then all of a sudden they fall back. And one of the other issues is we think of marijuana as a completely benign drug. It's not completely benign. New research has shown that when you smoke marijuana within 12 hours of driving, that you're actually twice as likely to crash your car as you are if you actually have a couple of drinks of alcohol. So I think the time has come for us again to look at drugs, look at it in the right way, and try to move forward from this terrible tragedy to improve others' lives.
800-462-7413, our number. And a listener now, Zorba, in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, for about 2 months now, I've been having some lower back pain. Not too severe, but enough to be an annoyance. A friend of mine recommended I use medical magnets, and I was calling to see if it's a waste of my time or if it's something that I should look into.
Well, wait a minute. Is the friend using these medical magnets?
Yes, and she swears by them, but I've heard there's a lot of controversy over whether or not they do actually work.
Does she also sell them by any chance?
No, she doesn't sell them.
How have they helped? What has changed from using them?
Well, for her, she's also been having lower back pain. She had thrown her back out, though. So she's been wearing a magnet bracelet for a couple of weeks now, and she says that the pain has gone away for the most part.
Well, let's look at the history of magnets. Magnets were really big and something that were used all the time in the 1880s and 1890s. If you look back in the medical literature, look back in old books, which you can get out of almost any library. It's wonderful. They put magnets in shoes. They put magnets in their back when they were walking because they thought magnets would actually have a lot of effect. And then it fell out of practice in the early 1900s because they discovered that magnets really didn't cure cancer and heart disease and stroke and so on. And it fell out basically for about 75 to 100 years. Nobody really discussed magnets at all. And then around the mid-1990s or early 2000, they started surfacing again. And my guess is there was probably somebody who said, hey, I bet magnets work, then started manufacturing them, put them in beds because back pain is common and people always think it's their bed that may be responsible for it. Many people are correct. Their bed is the wrong, firmness. And the scientific data on magnets is lacking. So spun a different way, there's nothing scientific that shows that a magnet will do anything at all. Now, this is not dissimilar from copper bracelets. There are people who wear copper bracelets and they say, it really helps my arthritis. I don't ache as much. Well, I think attitude has a lot to do with how much pain bothers you. And so I think if people feel better using a magnet, even if there isn't scientific evidence, there's no downside at all. Mm-hmm. But, magnets that go under the bed, some people spend $500 to $1,000 on those magnets. That's why Tom was asking. So how much are the magnets that she was recommending?
The ones she was recommending, I want to say they were in the range of about $100 to $150.
Yeah.
They weren't as expensive. It was a magnetic bracelet.
Yeah, so magnetic bracelet for $100, $150. A bracelet that you could buy in a hobby store if you made it yourself, which would probably cost $10. You can see what the markup is. But once again, there's no scientific evidence. So I always worry about this. Is this charlatanism? Is it quackery? Or is it just a style issue?
Well, doesn't it make life a little harder that your arm is always getting yanked when you go buy metal?
That's not always good. You do probably have to be careful around a computer because when you look at the hard drive is a magnetic drive. So you have to be careful around the computer if you're using it. So that's the skinny. The skinny is no scientific evidence, no downside. Is it going to work for you? The science says no. There's no evidence it will work for you. On the other hand, if you spend $100 or $150, you're invested in that. And so you may see something work for a couple of weeks. Yeah. That's not unusual. That's very common. There's a placebo effect. If you believe it works, it works. But that tends to fall away in about 4 to 6 weeks.
Does she have more of a magnetic personality now?
Well, I don't know about that, but...
So good luck. Good luck. And let us know if you buy the magnets, if they work for you, please.
All right. I'll do that.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. Today's myth deals with the common cold. Is it a myth that one person can catch two different colds at the same time?
The answer is it is not a myth. You can actually catch two different colds at the same time. And our colds, let's talk about colds.
Yeah.
They're viral infections and they're rhinoviruses. That's what they're called. They're viruses that rhine means no. Rhino means in the nose. Mm. So they're viruses that go in the nose. And at any particular time, there often are 100 strains of rhinoviruses during the cold season that are just kind of going around. And the present theory, they've looked at something called recombination, and where you can have two viral infections. They get together in your body. They swatch some they swap mm-hmm. some genetic material, and they can make another strain that actually is resistant to the first, sort of to the part of your body's antibodies to the first two strains. Mm. So rhinoviruses are really, really good at sort of dodging the bullet of being destroyed quickly by our circulating antibodies. And the answer is yes. You can have one, you can have two, and there are some studies that have shown that you could have three colds at
three
the same time.
Three different colds.
Yeah, and maybe that's why some people just, you know, they get cold after cold and they go, I'm just not getting any better. Well, the answer is you've had two colds.
So,
you know, you can't tell the difference.
So can we kill two colds with one pill?
When you find the pill, you let me in. You know what? We'll both split the $1 billion.
If you have a myth or two that's making you sick, send it to the show and we'll try to bust it. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our 800 number is 462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I'm calling because we have a kind of a family predicament where it's at first blush it seems kind of like I'm joking around, but I'm actually not. I have two brothers who have pretty bad gas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten to the, I mean, we've gotten used to it. It's always been this way ever since I can remember. And but the it seems like the odor is more intense than just regular gas. It's like sulfur times 1,000. And and we've all kind of joke and laugh about it. And but I guess I'm concerned that maybe there might be something wrong that's causing this, because I don't know anyone else who has experienced this type of, you know, odor before.
Yeah.
And or if it's not something that is, you know, I guess I'm wondering if long-term, if there's some kind of allergy or something going on that maybe, you know, some inflammation or something could be causing some long-term problems. I guess we're all kind of perplexed by this, and we've just kind of laughed it off and accepted that my brothers have bad gas.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if there's maybe something to it, more to it than that.
How old are the brothers?
They're in their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, gas is not a laughing matter. You know, we laugh about it, and we do laugh about it. I mean, gas and guys and with that. But people who have gas often have other problems. I mean, I'm not talking about physiological problems, but it's a social problem. You know, if you're out and you're with the guys out on a camping trip and you pass some gas, nobody really cares much. It's outside. But inside in a meeting and, you know, you're in a big city and all of a sudden you have gas that passes, it's a social issue. Often there's an eating relationship between eating and gas. So for some people, a high fiber diet causes more gas. So bran flakes in the morning, raisins in the morning, anything that we talk about with fiber is often gas producing. That's number one. Number two, look at the vegetables that they're eating. Cruciferous.
Yeah, they don't eat vegetables.
They don't eat vegetables.
No, they're like hamburgers and pizza guys, and they're also very their diet's very heavy in dairy.
Uh-huh. So they may want to reduce the dairy in their diet. I mean, they have a dietary thing is the only thing you can manipulate. If you use something like GasX, which is really an activated charcoal product, that's only going to work in the short run, and nobody's going to take some GasX every day for their gas. People just don't do it. They'll take it for a while and then they'll quit. So I would recommend, first of all, I talk to them and say, are you interested in fixing this or not? That's number one. And if they go, yeah, we really do want to fix this at all, they may not. I mean, you may be looking into them and they may have the issue, but the fact is they may just be in a habit of releasing their gas. We all have gas that we don't release at inappropriate moments. I mean, that's sort of what we learn to do when we're children. But you want to look at the food that they're eating. Dairy may be an issue because they may have some lactose intolerance. So one way to find out if that's an issue is they stop all dairy products for a couple weeks, nothing. We're talking about no cheese, no yogurt, no ice cream. They can't live in Wisconsin when that happens because cheese is all over. But they stop all dairy products and see if their gas goes away. If it goes away, they've got an answer. It's related to dairy products. If that's the case, then lactaid, which is an enzyme that they swallow that helps them digest a milk sugar, will help get rid of their gas. So number one, like you said, would be dairy products. They don't eat cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, and cauliflower. You don't have to worry about that. Sounds like they don't even care about fiber, like it's the farthest thing from their mind.
No,
unless a
no.
burger has fiber, they're not going to do it. And whole wheat is an anathema to them, so they won't even think about that. I think dairy would be the biggest bang for your buck.
Okay.
Good luck with recommending it to them. They may not be happy.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. We appreciate the call. You mentioned, or you asked her... do the brothers care about this? Way back when, my first year in college in the dorm, the two guys who were roommates next door to where I was in the dorm used to have contests. You know, four outbursts to three or seven. And they could go on and on and on.
I love it. Such a guy college thing.
The hour is almost up, Zorba. But before we leave for the week, let's play another round of Stump the Doc. Today's contestant is Greg from St. Augustine, Florida. Greg has an unusual problem where he falls asleep whenever he reads, even if it's early in the morning, and he's just gotten up. Starting to read will put him back to sleep. What's going on here?
I have to tell you, I fall asleep when I read. Not early.
Even in the morning.
Not in the morning.
Well, it's a relaxing thing.
Yeah, it's a relaxing thing. I think part of that is position. If I'm sitting up and I'm reading with a newspaper with coffee in my hand, it's one position. If I'm laying in bed, I'm going to go right back to sleep. I mean, that's ultimately what happens. What's going on? You're relaxed. You're enjoying something. Or there is another theory of what may be going on.
Which is?
You may be reading the wrong thing.
Maybe the St. Augustine record isn't up to par.
Or Beowulf. Maybe it's Beowulf. And Canterbury Tales, let's forget it. It's not what it's racked up to be. So, you know, that might be, you know, that's about what it is. It's a relaxing thing. Yeah. And that's about my best recommendation. Well, so.
At least Greg isn't falling asleep during this hour.
That's right. It's clear that you have to listen to more public radio and read less.
Think you can stump public radio's favorite family doc? Well, then send your question in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Garfield and Odie, better known as Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, are the two animals on the other side of the glass producing this hour. Adam Garfield Friedrich is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0218Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.